Chapter 14 of Rudolf Steiner's book, A Theory of Knowledge Implicit in Goethe's World Conception. Chapter 14 is Cognition and the Ultimate Foundation of Things. Kant took a great step forward in philosophy in that he directed man's attention to himself. He must seek the reasons for certitude regarding his affirmations in that which is given to him as the capacities of his own mind, and not in truths forced upon him from without. Scientific conviction only through oneself, that is the slogan of the Kantian philosophy. It is for this reason especially that he called it a critical and not dogmatic philosophy, such as maintains ready-made postulates as handed down and seeks afterward for the proofs of these. Here appears a contradiction between two scientific trends. But this was not thought out by Kant with that distinctness to which it lends itself. Let me read that sentence again. Here appears a contradiction between two scientific trends, but this was not thought out by Kant with that distinctness to which it lends itself. Let us fix clearly in mind how a scientific postulate comes into existence. It unites two things, either a concept and a percept, or two concepts. Of the latter sort, for example, is the postulate, no effect without a cause. It may be that the objective reasons why the two concepts flow together lie beyond that which these contain in themselves, and which alone, therefore, is given to me. I may then have all sorts of formal reasons, parenthesis, freedom from contradiction, fixed axioms, parenthesis, which lead me to a definite combining of thoughts. But these reasons have no influence upon the thing itself. The postulate rests upon something which I can never reach in an objective manner. Therefore, I can never have a real insight into the thing. I know about it only as one standing outside it. According to this view, that which the postulate expresses is in a world unknown to me. The postulate alone is in my own world. This is the character of dogma. There are two sorts of dogma, the dogma of revelation and that of experience. The former hands down to man in some way or other truths about things which are beyond the reach of his vision. He possesses no insight into the world from which these postulates spring. He must simply believe in their verity and cannot get access to the reasons for this belief. The case is quite similar with dogmas of experience. If anyone holds the opinion that we should simply limit ourselves to pure experience and can merely observe its transmutations without penetrating to the causative forces, he is applying to the world postulates whose reasons are inaccessible to him. Here also truth is not attained by insight into the inner agency of the thing, but it is imposed by what is exterior to the thing itself. If earlier science was dominated by the dogmas of revelation, contemporary science is suffering from the dogmas of experience. Our study has shown us that any assumption of a fundamental source of being which exists outside the idea is nonsense. The total fundamental essence of being has poured itself out in the world. It has passed over into the world. In thought, it is manifest in its most complete form, just as it is in and of itself. If then thinking forms a combination, if a judgment occurs, it is the content of the world fundament itself, poured out into thought, which is thus united. In thought, postulates are not given to us about a yonder side world fundament, but this in its very substance has flowed into thought. We have a direct insight into the objective, not merely formal, grounds for the formation of a judgment. The judgment reaches a characterization not about something alien, but about its own content. Therefore, our view lays foundations for a true knowledge. Our theory of knowledge is really critical. According to our view, not only need nothing be conceded to revelation, for which thought itself does not contain objective reasons, but also experience must be cognized within thought, not only on the side of its manifestation, but also as causative. By means of our thinking, we lift ourselves from perceiving reality as product to perceiving it as that which produces. The essential nature of a thing thus comes to light only when the thing is brought into relation with man. For only in man does the real being appear for each thing. This truth lays the foundation for a relativism as a worldview, that is, the trend of thought which assumes that we see all things in the light which is lent to them by man himself. This point of view bears the name anthropomorphism. It has many exponents. Most of these, however, believe that this peculiarity of our cognition alienates us from objectivity, as it is in and of itself. We perceive all, so they think, through the spectacles of subjectivity. Our conception shows the exact opposite of this. If we would reach the essential nature of things, we must view them through these spectacles. The world is not merely known to us as it appears, but it appears as it is, although only to thinking contemplation. The form of reality which man delineates in his knowledge is its final true form. And now we have still to extend to the individual fields of reality that form of cognition which we have come to recognize as the right form, as leading to reality in its true nature. We shall now show how the real nature of experience is to be found in its individual forms. Part E, The Science of Nature. Chapter 15, Inorganic Nature. The simplest form of action in nature seems to us to be that in which an occurrence results wholly from factors external to one another. Here is an occurrence or a relationship between two objects, not necessitated by an entity which manifests itself in the external forms of appearance, an individuality which exhibits its capacities and character in an effect produced outwardly. The occurrence or relationship has been called forth merely by the fact that one thing which has occurred has in its occurrence produced a certain effect upon another thing, has transferred its own state to some other thing. The states of one thing appear as results of those of another. The system of actions which happen in this fashion, so that one fact is always the result of others of similar sort, is called inorganic nature. Here the course of an occurrence, or the characteristic of a relationship, depends upon external determinants. The facts bear marks in themselves which are the results of these determinants. If the form is altered in which these external factors meet, the result of their combined existence is also naturally altered. The phenomenon thus brought about is altered. What is, now, the manner of this combined existence in the case of inorganic nature as it enters directly into our field of observation? It bears altogether the character which we designated above as that of immediate experience. We have here merely a special case of that experience in general. We have to deal here with connections between facts of the senses. But it is just these connections which seem to us in the experience not to be clear or transparent. The fact A confronts us, but at the same moment also numerous others. When we cast our glance over the multiplicity here presented to us, we are in a complete uncertainty as to which of these other facts stand in closer and which in more remote relationships to the fact A, now under discussion. There may be some present of such sort. There may be some present of such sort that the event could not occur without them, and others which merely modify it, but without which it could nevertheless occur, except that it would have, under the different circumstances, another form. In this way, we see at once the path which cognition must take in this field. If the combination of facts in immediate experience does not suffice us, then we must go forward to another combination satisfying to our need for explanation. We have to create such conditions that an occurrence will appear to us in transparent clarity as the inevitable result of these conditions. We recall why it is that thought contains its own essential nature in immediate experience. It is because we stand within and not without that process which creates thought combinations out of the single thought elements. Here, therefore, we are given not only the finished process, the product, but that which produces. And the important point is that when we confront any occurrence in the external world, we shall, above all, perceive the impelling forces which bring this forth from the center of the world totality to its periphery. The opacity or obscurity of any phenomenon or relationship in the sense world can be overcome only when we perceive adequately that it is the result of a certain association of facts. We must know that the occurrence we now see arises through the interaction of this and that element of the sense world. Then the manner of this interaction must be completely penetrable by our intellect. The relation into which the facts are brought must be an ideal relation, one suited to our minds. Of course, in the relationships into which things are brought by our intellect, they comport themselves according to their own natures. We see at once what is hereby gained. If I look haphazard into the sense world, I see occurrences brought about by the interaction of so many factors that it is impossible for me to see directly what really stands behind this effect as the causative element. I observe an occurrence, and at the same time the facts A, B, C, D. How shall I know at once which of these facts participate to greater and which to lesser extent in the occurrence? The thing becomes transparent when I first inquire which of the four facts is absolutely necessary if the process is to occur at all. I find, for example, that A and C are absolutely necessary. Then I find that without D the process occurs, indeed, but with important modification. And on the contrary, that B has no essential significance, but could be replaced by some other factor. In the above diagram, let I represent symbolically the grouping of the elements for mere sense perception. And this is just a square box with A, B, C, and D in the corners and connections on the outside perimeter and then also crosshairs, sort of a disorderedness. So let I represent symbolically the grouping of the elements for mere sense perception, and then number two, that for the mind. And in this one we have B at the top with two radiating lines. Well, it's hard to describe. Let's just say it's more ordered. Thus the mind so groups the facts of the inorganic world that it perceives in an occurrence or a condition the result of the relationship of the facts. Thus the mind introduces necessity into the midst of chance. We will make this clear by an example. When I have before me a triangle, ABC, I do not see at first glance that the sum of the three angles is always equal to two right angles. This becomes clear when I group the facts in the following manner. And then it shows a classic proof form of a triangle with a parallel line parallel to one of the sides and then all the interior angles, and etc. From the figures by the side of the triangle, it becomes clear at once that the angle A prime equals the angle A. They are alternate interior angles. The angle B prime equals the angle B, again, alternate interior angles. AB and CD are parallel to A prime, B prime, and C prime, D prime, respectively. If now I draw through the apex C of a triangle a line parallel to the base AB, I find when I apply the above example that the angle A prime equals the angle A, B prime equals B. Since now C equals itself, then of necessity the three angles of the triangle equal together two right angles. Here I have explained a complicated combination of facts by reducing it to such simple facts that by reason of the condition presented to the mind, the corresponding relationship is necessarily inferred from the nature of the things given. Another example is the following. I throw a stone in a horizontal direction. It describes a path which we have represented by the line LL. When I consider the impelling forces which are here to be taken into account, I find 1. The propelling force which I exerted, 2. The force with which the earth attracts the stone, 3. The force of the atmospheric resistance. Upon closer examination, I find that the first two forces are essential and determine the character of the path, while the third is subsidiary. If only the first two were present, the stone would describe the path a little bit higher curve. This latter I find when I ignore the third force and bring into combination only the former two. He ignores air friction. To carry this out in actual fact is neither possible nor necessary. I cannot eliminate all resistance. But for my purpose I need only apprehend in thought the nature of the first two forces, and then bring them into the necessary relationship likewise in thought. And I deduce the path LL prime as that which must necessarily result when only these two forces interact. In this way the mind resolves all phenomena of the inorganic world into those in which the effect seems to the mind to come directly and of necessity from the causative factor. If then, after arriving at the law of the motion of the stone, under the influence of the two forces, one introduces the third force, the result is the lower path. Additional conditions might complicate the matter still further. Every composite occurrence in the sense world appears as a web of such simple facts which can be penetrated by the mind, and it is reducible to these. Now, a phenomenon in which the character of the occurrence can be seen in transparently clear fashion to result directly from the nature of the factors under consideration is called a primal phenomenon, or fundamental fact. This primal phenomenon is identical with objective natural law. For in it there is expressed the fact not only that an occurrence happened under certain definite conditions, but that it had to happen. It has been seen clearly that the occurrence had to happen because of the very nature of the thing under consideration. The reason why empiricism is today so generally demanded is that it is supposed that any assumption which goes beyond what is empirically given leaves us groping in the uncertain. We see that we may remain wholly within the phenomena, and yet meet with the inevitable. The inductive method, today so much espoused, can never do this. In reality, it proceeds in the following manner. It observes a phenomenon which comes about in a definite manner under given conditions. Again, it sees the same phenomenon occur under similar conditions. From this, it concludes that there exists a general law according to which this occurrence must take place, and postulates this law as such. Such a method remains entirely external to the phenomena. It does not penetrate into the depths. Its laws are generalizations from individual facts. It must always await the establishment of the rule by the individual facts. Our method knows that its laws are simply facts which are torn out of the confusion of chance and made into matters of necessity. We know that when the factors A and B are present, a definite effect must appear. We do not go beyond the world of phenomena. The content of knowledge, as we view it, is nothing more than objective occurrence. The only change is in the form of the combination of facts. But this change advances one step deeper into objectivity than experience enables one to penetrate. We so combine the facts that they act according to their own natures, and only thus, and that this effect cannot be modified by this or that circumstance. Let me read that again. We so combine the facts that they act according to their own natures, and only thus, and that this effect cannot be modified by this or that circumstance. We attach the greatest importance to the fact that these discussions can be confirmed wherever one may look into the real functioning of science. They are contradicted only by the fallacious opinions that are held in regard to the scope and nature of scientific principles. While many of our contemporaries contradict their own theories when they enter the field of practical research, the harmony between our explanation and all true research can easily be shown in every single instance. Our theory demands for every natural law a definite form, It presupposes a combination of facts and maintains that when this appears anywhere in reality, a definite occurrence must take place. Every natural law, therefore, has this form. When this fact interacts with that, this phenomenon arises. It would be easy to show that all natural laws really have this form. When two bodies of unequal temperature are in contact, heat passes from the warmer to the less warm until the temperature of the two is the same. If a fluid is contained in two vessels which are connected, the level becomes identical in the two vessels. If a body stands between a source of light and another body, it casts a shadow upon the latter. In mathematics, physics, and mechanics, anything which is not mere description must be a primal phenomenon. All advance in knowledge rests upon the perception of primal phenomena. When we are able to remove an occurrence from its connection with other occurrences and explain it as the effect of definite elements of experience, then we have penetrated a step deeper into the fabric of the world. We have seen that the primal phenomenon yields itself wholly to thinking, when the factors concerned are brought together in thought according to their nature. But one can also create artificially the necessary conditions. This happens in scientific research. There we have in our own control the occurrence of definite factors. Naturally, we cannot ignore all related circumstances, yet there is a way by which we may surmount the latter. We may produce a phenomenon under various modifications. We allow first one and then another contributing circumstance to be active. We then find that one constant persists through all these modifications. We must retain the essential thing in all the combinations. We find that in all these individual experiences, a factual component of these is constant. This is higher experience within experience. It is the fundamental fact or primal phenomenon. The experiment is intended to convince us that nothing else influences a definite occurrence except what we take into account. We bring together certain conditions whose nature is known to us and observe what follows from these. Here we have an objective phenomenon on the basis of subjective creation. We have something objective which is at the same time thoroughly subjective. The experiment is therefore the true mediator between subject and object in inorganic science. The germ of the view we have here developed is to be found in the correspondence between Goethe and Schiller. Goethe's letters 410 and 413 and Schiller's 412 and 414 are concerned with this. They designate this method as rational empiricism because it takes as content for knowledge nothing except objective occurrences. But these objective occurrences are held together by a web of concepts, (laws), which our minds discover in them. Sensible occurrences in an interconnection which only thought can grasp. This is rational empiricism. If these letters are compared with Goethe's essay Der Versuch als Vermittler von Subjekt und Objekt, the theory given above will be found to be the logical conclusion to be drawn from them. The translation of that lecture is, or that essay is, The Experiment as Mediator Between Subject and Object. Back to the reading. Thus, the general relation we have defined between experience and knowledge is valid everywhere in inorganic nature. Ordinary experience is only one half of reality. To the senses, this half alone exists. The other half is present only to the conceptual capacities of our minds. The mind raises experience from an, quote, appearance for the senses, unquote, to something belonging to itself. We have shown how it is possible in this realm to raise oneself from the product to the producing. It is the mind that finds this latter when it confronts the former. Scientific satisfaction will come to us from a point of view only when it leads us into a totality complete in itself. But the sense world, as inorganic, does not appear at any point as brought to a conclusion. Nowhere does an individual whole appear. Every occurrence points to another, upon which it depends, this to a third, etc. Where is there any conclusion in this? The sense world, as inorganic, does not arrive at individuality. Only in its totality is it complete in itself. We must strive, therefore, if we would have a whole, to conceive the assemblage of the inorganic as a system. Such a system is the cosmos. A thorough understanding of the cosmos is the goal and ideal of inorganic natural science. Every scientific endeavor which does not attain to this is merely preparatory, a member of the whole, but not the whole itself. The end of chapter 15, in the end of this part of the recording, I'm now going to begin chapter 16, Organic Nature, page 82, in the next reading.